This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpuga, and here's what's coming up.
If the state and its security forces are able to rally such resources against small protests by a political party, why don't they do the same in communities under siege from criminal gangs?
That's reporter Darren Taylor on how a heavy police presence appeared to ease the risk of violence from a stay-home strike today in South Africa. Also, Nigeria media report about 20 people were killed during Saturday's elections. 9 Chinese nationals were killed at a gold mining site in the CAR, and supporters of Tunisia's President Kais Saied rallied today. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The U.S. State Department has just released its annual report on human rights practice, covering internationally recognized individual, civil, political, and worker rights as set forth in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other international agreements. It mentions Russia's invasion of Ukraine and China's abuses up top, but it also reports abuses in Sudan, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. Human Rights Watch says it, too, has been documenting violations and abuses in Africa and acknowledges the report is very thorough and clear. But Nicole Wedersham, a Human Rights Watch Washington Deputy Director and Africa expert, tells VOA Caravan Dam the problem is it's difficult to see how the annual report connects with U.S. policy.
The Biden administration has said many good things, and Secretary Blinken has said many good things on at a rhetorical high level on human rights and democracy, human rights as the indicator, warning lights and bedrock for democracy. But then when you see this level of detail that exists in the State Department on human rights abuses, you have to question, where does that connect with the regional bureaus who are in charge of the strategies for these countries and the U.S. priorities in these countries, including disincentives and other clear, tangible actions that could be done in reaction to what clearly the State Department knows is the human rights conditions for the people in these countries. So, you know, I'm going through this with a fine-tooth comb. You know, one of my colleagues saw an error in Indonesia on a law. You know, there might be some things there that we have good partnership with DRL. We can have an exchange on human rights information. But by and large, I mean, it's not that I would say it's not that I want to see something different or more in regards to the African sections in this report. I want to see the top leadership of the Biden administration using its own information on its policies towards these countries.
Well, as you know, Secretary Blinken was just there in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And it does for sure mention cases of abuse and violations in Ethiopia, but the UN and other reputable organizations have said there has been an estimated 500,000 people killed there in the 2-year war in Tigray. Did you find that interesting?
Yes. What I keep coming back to is that, you know, this is happening. You have the publicly available information. We're pretty sure that the U.S. has a ton more information in its intelligence community analysis on Ethiopia. It was tasked and said it was underway to do an atrocity crimes determination back in 2021. And yet, publicly, Secretary Blinken's going there and announcing with the president of that country who oversaw the leadership of that country during these crimes, that they're going to launch a transitional justice process, which the U.S. is going to support. It seems like these things are not connected. There's not reality connected to policy announcements, plans to work with these governments, and those that oversaw these violations and abuses. And this is where I also fall down on the level of detail on the abuses by security forces in Sudan in this report. And yet, the U.S. is sending out a senior diplomat, we don't know who it is, this week to oversee the signing of an agreement that keeps these security leaders in power in Sudan.
That was Nicole Welsham, Human Rights Watch Washington Deputy Director and African expert, speaking with my colleague Caro Van Dam. Nigeria's delayed second round of elections Saturday were disrupted by violence that media reports said had killed 20 people. Vote counting started after polling places closed on picking new state governors and legislatures. Results were expected as early as today. The Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, said security forces rescued 19 electoral officials who had been abducted by thugs in southeastern Imo State, a hotbed of separatist violence, but election materials were lost. The INEC is under scrutiny after observers from the European Union, the Commonwealth and other bodies reported several problems during last month's presidential election, among them failures in systems designed to prevent vote manipulation. Police in the Kenyan capital fired tear gas Monday at opposition supporters who were protesting the government and the high cost of living. At least one person was shot, and that person's condition was not immediately clear. Opposition leader Raila Odinga called for the protests Monday against President William Ruto, who he accuses of stealing last year's election. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
Raila Odinga's supporters demonstrated in Nairobi and other parts of the country Monday, engaging police in running battles. The Odinga motorcade was also tear gassed as it approached the Kenyatta International Conference Center. Protesters spoke of the high cost of living, alleged electoral irregularities, and alleged corruption in the government of President William Ruto. Kenyan police dispatched demonstrators in Nairobi with tear gas and water cannons, and at least one person was shot. Simon Kamau traveled from Machakos County to Nairobi to participate in the protest.
Leo niko barabarani juu ya unga, juu ya safa zifunguliwe.
He says, "I am demonstrating because of the high price of maize flour, and we want Electoral Commission to open its servers. I came to Nairobi last night," he says, "and I was here at 5:30 at the Kenyatta International Conference Center waiting for Raila Odinga." Another protester, Petit Musa, says the Ruto government must prove it won the election fairly.
Tunataka kitu ya kwanza, manual na electronic server ifunguliwe.
He says we want the manual and electoral presidential results to be released so that we can tell whether this Ruto government is legitimate. We also want the government to lower the prices of food, he says. President Ruto defeated his main challenger Raila Odinga in the August presidential election by a narrow margin. The Kenyan Supreme Court ruled that there was insufficient evidence to prove that the election was rigged. Odinga maintains that the Electoral Commission wrongfully denied him the presidency. Joseph Otiende, a Nairobi fishmonger, says there was no business Monday due to the protest.
All my businesses now are not going on. And I'm starving together with my family. There's no way I can get money. So why can't Ruto and Raila let them dialogue and things will just go on as usual?
Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua said Monday's protest has impacted shops in Nairobi's central business district.
This morning, because of lack of business in the CBD, the country has lost almost 2 billion shillings in terms of business. And this is money that should have been circulating in the economy. We want to urge these people to consider this afternoon to call off the chaos, the mayhem, the intimidation, because what they are doing is destroying our economy.
Opposition Member of Parliament Opiyo Wandayi says the protest will go on.
It will be extremely successful. This will go on indefinitely. There's no end time until all the demands are met.
Odinga told his supporters in Nairobi there will be protests every Monday. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Tunisia, several hundred supporters of President Kais Saied rallied today in support of his government. Elected in 2019, Saied has consolidated power by shutting down parliament and rewriting the constitution, saying he was trying to save the country from years of political chaos and economic stagnation. His government has cracked down on dissent, detaining politicians, union figures, judges, business leaders, and the head of an independent radio station. Reuters says hundreds of pro-Said protesters marched in central Tunis today, chanting the people of the country want to be cleansed. They also denounce what they call foreign interference and attacks on Tunisian sovereignty by the United States and the European Union, who are criticizing Said's crackdown on opponents. Most South Africans have ignored a call by the country's third biggest political party for a national shutdown today to protest against poor governance. The Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, had warned businesses, schools, universities and other institutions to stay closed today or face consequences. The EFF is leading demonstrations across South Africa today against the long power outages and are battering the economy and high crime and unemployment. Darren Taylor reports.
President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration says the EFF is trying to instigate regime change. It accuses the party of intimidating South Africans to stay home or join in violence against the state. The police and army are displaying heavy weaponry and patrolling the skies in helicopters. They're especially visible at shopping centres, airports, Parliament in Cape Town and the government union buildings in Pretoria. Police Minister Bheki Cele told reporters his officers would not allow a few troublemakers to hold the country to ransom.
We are closely monitoring the situation throughout the country and will act swiftly and decisively against any threats of disruptions. There will be high police visibility. Anyone who intimidates stops anyone from going to work, barricades the roads and highways, and uses any form of violence will face the full might of the law.
On Saturday, a judge granted chief opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, an interdict aimed at preventing the EFF from illegal activities related to its protests. At a rally in Soweto, EFF leader Julius Malema reacted with defiance.
We have no money, we have no weapon, we don't have machine guns, we only have the bodies of African people to put on the picket lines. Whether they kill or they don't kill, we will be on the streets of South Africa. We don't care what the security cluster says, we don't care what the judge says. No one can stop a revolution. But its time has come.
But, say analysts, if there's going to be a revolution, it won't happen today. EFF protests have been isolated. Police have arrested scores of people for alleged offences such as damage to public property. Malema denied any EFF member had threatened anyone ahead of the protest or had incited violence. But in the next breath, he issued a warning to companies and store owners.
We don't want to loot anyone's shop. Whether you open or you don't open, it's your own problem. Do not blame the EFF. If anything happens on Monday, you remain advised.
Many have not taken Malema's advice, including the country's biggest bus transport company, Putco. Spokesperson Lindu Kuhle Kulu says Putco initially decided not to operate after an internal security assessment found it couldn't guarantee the safety of drivers and passengers.
When we go into these communities, you find that when there is a protest, the usual thing that they do is to force our drivers to blockade some of those roads, and they sometimes burn our buses.
But, says Kulu, government officials assured Putco security forces would protect its vehicles, so it decided to be on the road as usual.
We are putting our trust on government, we are putting our trust on the law in South Africa, and we are putting our trust on the word of the minister, as well as the president himself, to say that anyone who would impede upon the movement or the activities of business would then be met by the full wrath of the law.
Many South Africans have been left asking, if the state and its security forces are able to rally such resources against small protests by a political party. Why don't they do the same in communities under siege from criminal gangs? For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Signers of the political deal in Sudan say transitional civilian government is expected to be named in April. Both civilian and military officials agreed Wednesday to expedite restoration of civilian rule in Sudan, where the military has ruled since 2021 coup. But some groups are against the framework agreement, and many Sudanese are skeptical that the military will ever give up power. Mike Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum, Sudan.
Signatories to the December 2022 political framework agreement met on Wednesday to discuss progress toward restoring a civilian-led government in Sudan. Speaking to the press shortly after the meeting, Khalid Omar Youssef, the official spokesperson of the civilian coalition that signed the agreement, says the meeting focused on expediting the process of drafting a new constitutional document. The document, he said, will be the basis to govern the upcoming transition in Sudan. He says participants also resolved to form a technical team that consists of representatives of the civilian coalition and military forces and other experts. The body will be tasked with reviewing the agreement and drafting the constitution. He said the meeting discussed the general progress on the political process and resolved a number of issues, including discussion on the remaining two complex matters, the transitional justice and the military and security reforms. He said those two issues are to be discussed in the ongoing political conference that should end before the holy month of Ramadan. Ramadan begins March 23rd. The December 2022 political agreement requires that the parties to the political process organize a conference to discuss issues that need a national consensus. Youssef says once discussions on transitional justice and military and security reforms are finished, the technical committee will start drafting a final political agreement that will lead to the establishment of a new civilian government in early April. He said the Joint Technical and Coordinated Committee that comprises the signatories to the agreement and the trilateral mechanism is expected to urgently draft a new time frame for the discussion of the remaining issues before signing of the final political agreement as soon as possible. Some signatories to the December 2022 political agreement, which aimed at settling Sudan's internal conflict, refused to join the ongoing political process because they reject the framework and want to maintain the 2019 constitutional declaration made after the overthrow of longtime President Omar al-Bashir. Many Sudanese are skeptical the military will completely give up power regardless of any deals that are struck. Khartoum resident Sahar al-Juzuli says the October 2021 military coup negatively affected the revolution for democratic rule in Sudan and said supporters of democracy will not accept any agreement that does not serve justice. Speaking to VOA via a messaging application Friday, al-Juzuli says Sudanese people are now more aware of their rights and they will continue to speak up once they realize the framework agreement does not serve their interest. Our people have learned a lot, she said, and they became more aware of their political rights as citizens by participating in the revolution. The Sudanese people learned and understood the meaning of uprooting rights, she said. They became determined toward achieving the slogans of the revolution, freedom, peace and justice. However, another Khartoum resident, Al-Nazir Adam Musa, applauded the military for what he called courageous steps to leave the political scene and allow the country to be under civilian rule. He said, what we expect from the current framework agreement is that it would help the country to overcome the ongoing political deadlock because the military is determined to hand over power to civilians. He said, this is a good gesture so far. Ibrahim El-Merghani, the head of the political bureau at the opposition Democratic Unionist Party, predicted the ongoing talks on the framework will bear fruit. There are not many differences among national political forces about the transitional issues, he said. He added, the differences will not affect the dialogue, which he forecast will lead to completion of the transitional period and sustainable democracy in the country. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum.
You listen in to Africa News tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Nine Chinese nationals were killed early yesterday at a gold mining site in the Central African Republic. The Associated Press says a rebel coalition blamed for the attack, the Coalition of Patriots for Change, accused Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group of carrying out the violence. The mayor of a nearby town, Bambari, told AP that the attackers overpowered the site's guards just a few days after the mine opened. China's embassy is urging its citizens to avoid traveling outside the capital, Bangui. Reuters says the Chinese president has called for severe punishment for the perpetrators. The attack came days after a gunman kidnapped three Chinese nationals near the border with Cameroon, prompting President Faustin Touadera to plan a trip to China to reassure investors. Many of the mines in the country are run by Chinese investors. In recent days, many Congolese from the North and South Kivu provinces in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo have reported problems crossing the border into Rwanda. The migration services of both countries have tightened measures for travel and migration. The move has come as a surprise for citizens of the DRC, who expected more flexibility when it recently joined the East African Community. Our reporter in Goma, Zanem Nate Zaid, went to the border and has this report.
At the barrier between the towns of Goma in DRC and Gisenyi in Rwanda, Eugenie Wase, a young Congolese businesswoman, stands under a tree. She has to return to the town center in Goma. Rwandan customs officers would not let her cross the border. She has brought her card for the community of Great Lakes countries, but she leans that a visa is required. Eugenie says that now everyone is required to get an annual visa. However, before they could simply cross with the card for the community of Great Lakes countries. According to Congolese professor Dadi Saleh, people in both countries now have to adapt to this process, which has become quite normal. He says if he has to clarify things, he would explain that these are two different countries. There are work visas and residence permits and two different documents. You can't go to another country without work documents, just as you can't work there without documents that respect international law. Although there is a principle of free movement between the member countries of the East African Community, Dadi Saleh says that is not clear that this is being implemented between the DRC and Rwanda. He says he understands that with the tensions between the two neighboring countries, it is not likely that there will soon be measures taken to ensure the free movement between the two countries of the East African Community. Diplomatic relations between the DRC and Rwanda are deeply troubled, with Kinshasa denouncing Kigali for providing military support to the M23 rebels, but Rwanda denies the charge. From Goma, I'm Zanem Netizaidi for VOA Africa.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and Alfredo, our engineer, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.